I am bursting to tell you guys about this book. I had one enormous takeaway that has completely transformed my writing. No book has ever evoked so much emotion out of me. I was just like, I was so angry and appalled and oh my God, I could not, every little story, I was just like, oh my God, this is insane. So I want to tell you what the big takeaway was. I'm going to talk a lot about it and I'm going to give you so many examples, but I want to just quickly tell you what the book is about. So The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls is about her upbringing, her childhood, her parents. She lives with her parents, her older sister, Lori, her brother, Brian, he's a year older than her, and her younger sister, Maureen. And it's just, it's kind of an atrocious upbringing. And we just see time and time again, over and over, how her parents neglect their kids and how selfish they are and how dangerous their lives were. And it's a miracle that they all survived. So something that I realized reading this book is that, okay, she does have an amazing, insane story. These stories are just like, you would not believe, but it's not the story that was so compelling. It was the way that she told it. And I really believe now, especially after telling you guys how I'm like not going to read any more of these celebrity memoirs, because the celebrity memoirs, usually there's this amazing story about this famous person. And they are. It's like a crazy story of how they came to be. And it's really interesting. But then the way they tell it, it just falls flat. And it's not that engaging. So you don't need to have something crazy to have happened in your life to be a great storyteller. So let me tell you what I did. Through the book, this is what I always do. I underline passages or lines that evoke a strong emotion. Like in this book, anytime I was just like, oh my God, I need to put the book down for a second, I would underline it. And most of the time, I didn't know why the passage hit me so hard, but it just did. And so I underlined it. So then this is what I always do is I do that. And then after I finish the book, I go through and I just copy everything I've highlighted into my note-taking system, into Evernote. And what I'll do is I'll reread the passage and I'll see, did it hit me the same way? And if it does, then that's when I start dissecting it. And I say, what did she do here? What language did she use? What phrasing, what verbiage, like all that kind of stuff. And I just look at it and I analyze it. And the thing it took me so long to realize, I couldn't believe how long it took me to realize this, but what Jeanette did was she did not write thoughts or feelings. All she wrote was what happened and what was said. And the whole book, I am rooting so much for Jeanette and feeling so much anger towards her parents. And I realized it was because she did not share her thoughts or her feelings, and she did not write anybody else's thoughts or feelings. All she did was present the story. Because the thing is I don't want to be told what happened. I want you to hold my hand and show me and say, look, this is what happened. Here, look at this movie I've made for you. There's just something about that is incredibly compelling, and it allows me to have a lot of feelings and emotions about what has been written. So let me give you some examples. Okay. This is the first one. On page 28, she writes, Mom always said people worry too much about their children. Suffering when you're young is good for you, she said. It immunized your body and soul, and that was why she ignored us kids when we cried. Fussing over children who cry only encourages them, she told us. That's positive reinforcement for negative behavior. So everything in these few lines is something her mom told her directly. She has no response to it. She has no thoughts about it. It's not actually quoted. Like it's not a direct quote, but it's coming directly from her mom. These were her words spoken. You can see how she says, Mom always said, suffering when you're young is good for you, she said. Fussing over children who cry only encourages them, she told us. You know, so she keeps just repeating that this is being told to her by her mom. So all Jeanette does here is write what her mom said to them. And I'm like, what the fuck? Who does this lady think she is? And I'm very worked up about it. And if Jeanette said how she thought about this and what her reaction was to this, it wouldn't have landed as much. I wouldn't have had such a visceral reaction to it. Here's another example. This kid, Billy Deal, he had a crush on Jeanette. And this is when she's like 10 or something. And the day before, he attacks her and tries to rape her. But she like bites him in the face and gets away. So now it's the next day. She's with her brother, Brian, and her older sister, Lori, and her baby sister, Maureen, who at this time is like, she needs to be held. I know that. She's little. She's like a toddler, I think. So on page 87, she writes, "We heard Billy Deal outside calling my name. Lori looked at me and I shook my head. We went back to our card game, but Billy kept on. So Lori went out on the porch, which was the old platform where people used to board the train, and told Billy to go away. She came back in and said, 'He's got a gun.' Lori picked up Maureen. One of the windows shattered, and then Billy appeared framed in it. He used the butt of his rifle to knock out the remaining pieces of glass, then pointed the barrel inside. 'It's just a BB gun,' Brian said. 'I told you you'd be sorry,' Billy said to me and pulled the trigger. It felt like a wasp had stung me in the ribs. Billy started firing at us all, working the pump action quickly back and forth before each shot. Brian pushed over the spool table and we all crouched behind it." Oh my God. Like, oh. Okay. This passage, she includes what was said, and then the rest of it is straight up action. What happened? She didn't say, "It was insane," or "Can you believe he started shooting at us?" She doesn't say that she was scared. She doesn't say that she was in pain, which I'm sure that she was. When she gets shot, she describes what it felt like by comparing it to something else. She doesn't say she gasped or she clutched her side, because that, my friends, is dead language. It's just as bad as a cliche. It's not interesting. She said it felt like a wasp had stung her in the ribs. That is not something I've heard before. That makes me think like, oof, I know what that felt like. I know what it felt like when she got stung by that BB gun. Also, she didn't once say how she felt about Billy. This kid tried to rape her the day before, and now he's at her house with a gun, and he's shooting at them, her and her all of her siblings. Like, this is a horribly traumatic, terrifying experience. And I have so many feelings because she didn't tell me to. Okay, I can't stop, and we're going to keep going. In this next passage, she's maybe 12 or 13, and her dad, like, leaves her with some older man, knowing that he's going to try to have sex with her, or at least, like, make out with her, make advances at her. She gets away, and now her and her dad are driving home together. So on page 213, she writes, "Dad, that creep attacked me when we were upstairs." "I'm sure he just pawed you some," Dad said as we pulled out of the parking lot. "I knew you could handle yourself." The road back to Welch was dark and empty. The wind whistled through the broken window on my side of the Plymouth. Dad lit a cigarette. "It was like that time I threw you into the Sulphur Spring to teach you how to swim," he said. "You might have been convinced you were going to drown, but I knew you'd do just fine." Okay. Three things here. First, sometimes, and I've talked about this before, but the strongest way to end a story is with the last thing someone said, without your reaction to it. Okay? She ends with what he said, which is a fucking insane thing to say, which I'll get to, but he ends with this quote, and it reminded me of how I loved the ending of the Santaland Diaries. And I know I keep talking about the Santaland Diaries because it's such an amazing essay by David Sedaris, but in the Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris ends with a quote from someone else, and I'll read it to you again because it's so good. David Sedaris writes, "She laid her hand on my shoulder, squeezed it gently, and continued her conversation, saying, 'Don't tell the store president I called you a bitch. Tell him I called you a fucking bitch, because that's exactly what you are. Now get out of my sight before I do something we both regret.'" It's just so funny. And there's no reaction to it. So I just want to reiterate that point because I think it's a really strong way to end a story. Second point, she says he attacked her, and he responds, "Oh, I'm sure he just pawed you some. I knew you could handle yourself." Now, the easy thing to write here, the next thing to write, would be her reaction. Her thoughts in her head about that, what her dad just said to her. But she doesn't do that. She continues the story. What was happening? She shows us what it looked like. The next lines after that sentence are, "The road back to Welch was dark and empty. The wind whistled through the broken window on my side of the Plymouth. Dad lit a cigarette." It's a movie. It's a movie. She's showing us what was happening. We're not seeing inside her head. We're seeing what the scene looked like. Okay, there's just silence between them. There's no words spoken after what her dad said. Okay, as the reader, I'm like, this is so fucked up. But Jeanette isn't telling me it's fucked up. I am deciding that for myself. Okay, and then the third thing here. Okay, at the end, for this last quote, he refers back to when he taught her how to swim by essentially letting her sink over and over again, which was horrible. And now I'm just like reminded of that, and I'm pissed off even more. So this is just another way to treat your audience like a genius, okay? She is not telling us how she feels or what we should feel. She is just showing us exactly what happened. Okay, here's another one that just like got me so fired up. So I have to share this. So now she's in college and her parents are homeless on the streets of New York City. And at this point, they've had a lifetime of opportunities to work and make money. Like, her mom has a college degree. She could be a teacher, but she just hates it and she would rather not. And they could just live like normal citizens, but they refuse to. At one point, she actually says to her mom, "Mom, you can't live like this." And her mom says, "Why not? Being homeless is an adventure." Like, it's just bonkers. So anyway, so she's in college, as I said. And on page 256, she writes, "One day, Professor Fuchs asked if homelessness was the result of drug abuse and misguided entitlement programs, as the conversations claimed, or did it occur, as the liberals argued, because of cuts in social service programs and the failure to create economic opportunity for the poor. Professor Fuchs called on me. I hesitated. Sometimes I think it's neither. Can you explain yourself? I think that maybe sometimes people get the lives they want. Are you saying homeless people want to live on the street?" Professor Fuchs asked. "Are you saying they don't want warm beds and roofs over their head?" "Not exactly," I said. I was fumbling for words. "They do, but if some of them were willing to work hard and make compromises, they might not have ideal lives, but they could make ends meet." Professor Fuchs walked around from behind her lectern. "What do you know about the lives of the underprivileged?" she asked. She was practically trembling with agitation. "What do you know about the hardships and obstacles that the underclass faces?" The other students were staring at me. "You have a point," I said. Oh my God. In my notes, I'm like, why is this so good? I'm like, Jeanette knows everything. Not everything. She knows a lot about being underprivileged. It's a miracle she's sitting in a college lecture hall. It's a miracle that she's even alive, lady. Like, back up. Oh man, I was so fired up. So most of this passage is dialogue. It was what was said. At one point, she said the teacher was trembling with agitation. Okay, the trembling we can see, but the agitation she's telling us. So I want to make it clear that it's not removing all thoughts and feelings, but for Jeanette, it's got to be like 98%. So it's a lot. She chose that one moment to just show us like how this teacher looked like she was about to explode at her. And again, for the end of the story, she ends with the quote. She ends with what she said. "You have a point." And I'm like, no! It's so powerful, right? Like, it was so strong. So, you know, I want my writing to be like this. I want to do this. And I want to evoke strong emotions out of the reader without telling them how I feel about everything. Okay, let me do one more. I know this is a lot, but I just think it's so good. And I just think it's worth reiterating. And these examples are incredible. Okay, so at one point, Brian and Jeanette found this ring in like the woods and they think it might be worth something. And most of the book, most of their upbringing, the kids are pretty much starving. Like they never have any food. It's always a fight for survival. And so this is just like a constant problem for them. So on page 186, she writes, "We brought the ring home and showed it to Mom. She held it up to the light, then said we needed to have it appraised. The next day, she took the Trailways bus to Bluefield. When she returned, she told us it was, in fact, a genuine 2-carat diamond. 'So what's it worth?' I asked. 'That doesn't matter,' Mom said. 'How come?' 'Because we're not selling it.' 'She was keeping it,' she explained, 'to replace the wedding ring her mother had given her, the one Dad had pawned shortly after they got married.' 'But Mom,' I said, 'that ring could get us a lot of food. That's true, Mom said, but it could also improve my self-esteem. And at times like these, self-esteem is even more vital than food. Mom's self-esteem did need some shoring up. Sometimes things just got to her. She retreated to her sofa bed and stayed there for days on end, crying and occasionally throwing things at us. She could have been a famous artist by now, she yelled, if she hadn't had children, and none of us appreciated her sacrifice. Isn't this so crazy? Okay, so my favorite thing about this point is just an extra point I wanted to add, is that when her mom says this absolutely insane line, self-esteem is even more vital than food, when the kids are starving, Jeanette's next line is, mom's self-esteem did need some shoring up. Then she tells another story of her mom. It's another anecdote. It's an image. Again, not telling us things. She's showing us that her mom retreated to her sofa bed. She threw things at us. She cried. She declared she could have been a famous artist by now. Like, these are all things that create an image and a movie for us to watch instead of her telling us. All right, this next section I've titled Drops Bombs Like They're Nothing. Okay, on page 64, she writes, our house in Battle Mountain was filled with animals. They came and went, stray dogs and cats, their puppies and kittens, non-poisonous snakes, and lizards and tortoises we caught in the desert. A coyote that seemed pretty tame lived with us for a while, and once Dad brought home a wounded buzzard that we named Buster. Okay. So this is what she does all the time. She downplays shocking things. And at the time, she probably didn't think anything of it because that's what she knew. Like, this was her life. But to say a coyote that seemed pretty tame lived with us for a while, as a parent now, I really gasped at this. Because a coyote? Like, with little kids? That coyote could eat a child. I think that the thing that she did here that was really, maybe, like, that really made it feel like a bomb was that the first one seemed pretty, like, totally safe. Stray dogs, cats, puppies, kittens, non-poisonous snakes. I was like, yeah, that's kind of not really my thing, but okay. Lizards, tortoises, like, these are all friendly creatures. And then she says the coyote line. And it's not even, like, that's not even it. That's only, like, the first part of the sentence. A coyote that seemed pretty tame lived with us for a while. And once, Dad brought home a wounded buzzard that we named Buster. Okay, I'm pretty sure buzzards are pretty scary, too. I Googled them because I didn't really know what they were. They're just, like, they're a bird, but they're kind of like a scary kind of bird. But the way that she put the coyote living with them in, and then just being like, and that's just like one thing. I think that is the trick here, is like you put it in, but then you just keep going. So I definitely want to try this. Okay, this was like a really big one. So in fifth grade, this girl, she got bullied by this girl, and then they become friends. So now, 2 years later, it's seventh grade. The girl's name is Denisha. And she notices that Denisha has changed. She's lost her spark. She starts drinking malt liquor. And she tells Jeanette that her mom's boyfriend moved in with them. And that, like, it's not good, basically. And then later, she, like, slips her a note during class. And she tells her that she's pregnant. So then this next part happens on page 199. After Christmas, Denisha did not return to school. When a month had gone by, I walked around the mountain to her house and knocked on the door. A man opened it and stared at me. He had skin like an iron skillet and nicotine yellow eyes. He left the storm door shut, so I had to speak through the screen. Is Denisha home? I asked. Why you want to know? I want to see her. She don't want to see you, he said, and shut the door. I saw Denisha around town once or twice after that, and we waved but never spoke again. Later, we all learned she'd been arrested for stabbing her mother's boyfriend to death. And then after that line, she just moves on to another story. She just moves on. That's the last word we hear about Denisha. Like, Denisha has been a character in the book for a few chapters now. It was up and down. It was really cool that they, like, became friendly. And then she was arrested for stabbing her mother's boyfriend to death. Like, what? Okay, something here also is that she doesn't tell us, Jeanette doesn't tell us that the boyfriend got her pregnant. She just says that the boyfriend's mom moved in and Denisha changed. And then later, like, she slips her a note that says she's pregnant. So as the reader, I'm kind of like putting it together, like, oh God, Did the boyfriend, oh God, this is horrible. And then when we find this reveal that she stabbed the mother's boyfriend to death, well, then I'm like, well, yeah, I think he did get her pregnant. And you know, we still don't know. No, we don't know for sure. But it's really, this is such a cool way to treat your audience like a genius. You don't need to tell them these things. You just tell what happened. You tell how Denisha changed. You tell how they stopped speaking to each other. You tell her the things her mom's boyfriend moved in. She tells her she's pregnant. Like, we can put this stuff together ourselves. And Jeanette is really just telling her what happened. She's not assuming anything. She's not having any thoughts about it. She's just telling us what happened. I know I keep saying the same thing over and over again, but these passages are just so good. All right, a couple more things. So let me take a sip of coffee. Quick shout out to everyone who is freezing and sweating all the time. I started this podcast with a sweater on because I was chilly. And then I start sweating and I have to put it off. And in about 3 minutes, I'll probably have to put it back on. All right, anyway. There is something I want to talk about with lists. Sometimes a list, a really long list, can evoke emotion. So this is happening on page 92. And up until this point, now we've seen how the family has been living, how they never have any money, how they're always struggling for food, for even to, like, you know, have a roof over their heads. And then the mom's mom dies and gets this inheritance. So she gets money and she gets a house. So on page 92, she writes, "The house with the green shutters was more valuable, but Mom had chosen the Adobe house. It was near Phoenix's business district, which made it a perfect place for Mom to start an art studio. She'd also inherited some money so she could give up teaching and buy all the art supplies she wanted." Okay, and then 5 pages later, she writes, "An art supply store was 3 blocks away on North 1st Street. And thanks to Mom's inheritance, we were able to make regular shopping expeditions to the store, bringing home rolls of canvas that Dad stretched and stapled onto wooden frames. We also brought back oil paints, watercolors, acrylics, gesso, a silk screening frame, India ink, paint brushes and pen nibs, charcoal pencils, pastels, fancy rag paper for pastel drawings, and even a wooden mannequin with movable joints whom we named Edward and who, Mom said, would pose for her when we kids were off at school." And then on the next page, she wrote, "Mom was also hard at work on her writing. She bought several typewriters, manuals, and electrics so she'd have backups should her favorite break down." With everything she lists, I'm getting more and more stressed out and worked up because they don't know how to or care to know how to manage their money and take care of their kids. Like, they're constantly starving. They're constantly struggling. And they get this money and they're just going to blow it all away. And you can see it happening with each thing that they buy. Like, you just know that this is going downhill. The typewriters, several typewriters. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? I was trying to think, like, when can I list something that with each thing I list, it gets the reader more and more worked up or stressed out. Then I was thinking about this. I remembered that Cheryl Strayed did this in Wild. When she is packing up for her hike across the Pacific Crest Trail, she lists everything that she put in her pack. And it was absolutely outrageous. The list was, like, it was so long and so heavy. And then when she finally gets all of this stuff packed, she could barely lift it. She could barely stand. She could barely walk. Like, when she listed all this and then she finally, like, somehow gets it on her back, as I'm reading it, I'm sure that she's going to, like, very quickly get rid of the stuff, but she doesn't. It's insane that she keeps this pack filled so much with so many heavy things, so many unnecessary things. And so as you're reading the list, you're just like, you are an idiot. What are you doing? Stop. So I was trying to think of something that I could do. And I'm not sure if this is it, but when I broke up with my boyfriend of 8 years, I went and stayed with my friends in Topanga, and they were this married couple with 2 kids. And I didn't have a lot of stuff, But what I did insist on keeping was ridiculous. Like, I had this solid oak coffee table that I couldn't lift on my own. I had this, like, this Eddie Bauer end table that I bought for $40 at a Goodwill. I had these glass etched platters, like they were Christmas scenes etched in glass on these big platters that I also bought at some kind of thrift store. I had like half kitchen sets of like my boyfriend and I had like, you know, like a set of four bowls or something. And I only kept two because I thought that he would want the other half. And I didn't talk to him about anything. Like, I just went to the apartment and I got all my stuff and I left. So I was like taking half of everything, and which was so dumb because he is a dude. And you know what he did all that stuff? I am sure I just have this image in my head of him just taking everything out of the cabinet and putting it directly in a trash bag. But anyway, so I had all this like shit and I insisted on keeping it. And my friends had no space for it. And I was just like, no, I need all these things. And they were so nice and accommodating. And I'm like, what an asshole that I was to keep all this shit. So that could be funny. Okay, I want to talk about this moment of resolution. And it made me think about moments of resolution to write about in general. So on page 220, she writes, "Dad was standing between me and the door. There was no way out except through him. But it never occurred to me to either run or fight. The way I saw it, he was in a tighter spot than I was. He had to back down, because if he sided with Mom and gave me a whipping, he would lose me forever. We stared at each other. Dad seemed to be waiting for me to drop my eyes, to apologize and tell him I was wrong so we could go back to being like we were. But I kept holding his gaze. Finally, to call his bluff, I turned around, bent over slightly, and rested my hands on my knees. I expected him to turn and walk away, but there were six stinging blows on the backs of my thighs, each accompanied by a whistle of air. I could feel the welts rising even before I straightened up." So then right after this, she leaves the house and she just keeps walking and walking through the woods until she comes to a tree to rest. She writes, "All through the long walk, the pain had kept me thinking, and by the time I reached that trunk, I had made two decisions. The first was that I'd had my last whipping. No one was ever going to do that to me again. The second was that, like Lori, I was going to get out of Welch. The sooner the better." So this is a pivotal moment. And she has decided that she is done with this life with her family. And she's determined, will stop at nothing to get out. And she does. And so I was trying to think of when bad things that have happened or hard things that have happened that made me resolute. And I was thinking how when I came out of the haze of the breakup with the guy, the second guy that I was with for 7 months that I thought I was going to marry, the guy that was like really narcissistic and messed me up. It had been about 2 months after the breakup. I was still like a little bit too connected to John. So like I think I still followed him on Instagram and, you know, still had texted with him. And about 2.5 months after we broke up, he texted me that he wanted to meet up for coffee. And I was just like, why? And I asked him like, why? And he said something about being friends and putting it behind us or something. And when he texted me that, I like finally realized that he only cared about appearances and being liked by everybody. And I can't remember what I texted back exactly, but I told him no. And I said I was flying to my friend's, I was flying to Mexico for my friend's wedding anyway. And then right after I texted him, and it was like not a nice text, I blocked him. And that was the moment for me. I blocked him and I decided right then that I would never be with someone ever again who made me feel bad about myself. And the next day I got on that plane and 2 days later I met Sam. Okay, finally, I want to talk about the ending. When I first read these lines, I didn't think much of them. But then when I was rereading them, I was like, oh, this has more meaning than I thought. So there is a family Thanksgiving dinner. And at this point, her dad has passed away and her youngest sister is living in California and her and the rest of her family are all in New York. So it's her, her mom, her brother, Brian, her sister, Lori, and now her husband. And it's this nice family gathering and they're doing a toast before they eat. And these are the last lines. "We raised our glasses. I could almost hear Dad chuckling at Mom's comment in the way he always did when he was truly enjoying something. It had grown dark outside. A wind picked up. rattling the windows, and the candle flame suddenly shifted, dancing along the border between turbulence and order. And I read this and I was like, oh, it's like a metaphor. Like, okay, this is how I was thinking about it. The family, like, this is like a, you know, happy Thanksgiving picture. Happy family, sort of. You know, it's like, it's as if there's order in their lives, but who knows what's going to happen next? You know, this is not the end of this, the family drama, all the stuff. There's been so much turbulence in Jeanette's life that maybe her family will always be dancing along the border between turbulence and order. So I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. So then I Googled it and it got even cooler. I found out that these last lines were a callback. So it's a callback and it's a metaphor. It's a callback metaphor. What? Okay, so let me tell you about the callback. When Jeanette and Brian were kids, they set a batch of hazardous waste on fire and Brian was nearly killed. Now, this is one of those stories in the book that, like, there's so many stories that are insane and feel like near death, but this one was like really, really bad. And just by luck, their dad was around and got him out. And the three of them, so Jeanette, Brian, and their dad were standing outside of this like shack and they're watching the fire. And then their dad describes to them a concept of physics of the hazy area that manifests over a flame. And she writes at this time, "Dad told us that zone was known in physics as the boundary between turbulence and order. It's the place where no rules apply, or at least they haven't figured them out yet," he said. "You all got a little too close to it today." So you could say the whole story was a balance between turbulence and order. There was so much chaos in Jeanette's life, and she was constantly trying to have some control over her situation, trying to get order in her life. A callback metaphor like that is so good. And it was such a subtle callback. I love the idea of the callback being just a phrase. The phrase that she called back to was dancing along the border between turbulence and order. I missed it. I missed it on the first read. It didn't catch it. I am wondering for myself. I love the idea of doing a callback for the last lines. That's really cool. I don't know if I wanted to be like, I mean, it is treating your audience like a genius to remember this, but I didn't remember this. So I think the word choice is really important on the callback, so that it's unique, so that it's easy to remember. Okay, the last thing I want to leave you with is because I didn't actually talk about what the glass castle was. So I just want to tell you what the glass castle was. It was a place, a promise, a project that never happens. It's something that Jeanette's dad promised his kids from the time they were little. Time and time again throughout her life, Jeanette's dad would let her down, and the glass castle was no exception. So, and let me just read to you the first mention of the glass castle on page 25. "When Dad wasn't telling us about all the amazing things he had already done, he was telling us about the wondrous things he was going to do, like build the glass castle. All of Dad's engineering skills and mathematical genius were coming together in one special project, a great big house he was going to build for us in the desert. It would have a glass ceiling and thick glass walls and even a glass staircase. The glass castle would have solar cells on top that would catch the sun's rays and convert them into electricity for heating and cooling and running all the appliances. It would even have its own water purification system. Dad had worked out the architecture and the floor plans and most of the mathematical calculations. He carried around the blueprints for the glass castle wherever he went, and sometimes he'd pull them out and let us work on the design for our rooms. All we had to do was find gold, Dad said, and we were on the verge of that. Once he finished the prospector and we struck it rich, he'd start work on our glass castle."